You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Great heavens! What kind of radio show is this?
And when it came out that these X-Files were still in his, were part of that archive, did the Army or anybody try and go and take those back? Because it sounds like they were, like, super classified.
No. Well, when I'm discovering these, and by the time I got them, I think it was 95 or so, right? Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, a generation has passed.
Yeah.
And at this point, Shag Harbor, you know, isn't on your television or isn't, you know.
Yeah.
And nobody was just doing the follow-up. And look, be honest, when I first sent these requests after I found where to do such a thing, you know, in 93, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm writing to the Department of National Defense and to National Archives and these agencies here in Canada. Often, like when I wrote to the Department of National Defense, a few days later, a researcher on the floor called me up on the telephone and said, are you sure about this? Were we there? Did we do something? Like, they were unaware, right? Now, they're aware of it now, but, you know, at the time, nobody had looked for these, right?
Yeah.
And they were quite surprised, and I thought, well, God, this, you know, I'll be lucky to see anything. But 2 days later, this young lady phoned me back and indeed had a dozen good documents and some other suggestions and mailed them to me. But, you know, they were really largely sort of uninterested, right? But, and then when connections were made, other files have been found and they've been made public now. I mean, this case is quite famous. At the time, it was off everybody's radar. But, I mean, some of the young staff that were now trainees and researchers on the floor that deal with public requests were unaware of their involvement with UFOs, you know? And at the time, remember, these departments are officially no longer involved. You know, kind of like the U.S. Air Force. If you just write them and you ask them, they'll say, well, we're not involved in UFO research anymore.
Yeah.
Well, certainly Blue Book was canceled. Certainly the public effort doesn't exist. But, you know, if you're a part of certain divisions, I mean, believe me, you know, some near collision that involves an unknown object will be investigated.
Yeah.
It may not be a UFO investigation, but, you know, call it whatever you want. You know, that's what it is. So, you know, that's it. It's a bit different now. So, but those were the glory days in the beginning. There were lots of documents. You know, they're harder to come by, but they still surface occasionally, right? Now, there are four primary sources of documents on these: Department of National Defense, National Archives, the Burt Gaffney Archives. But one of the other great sources was an early APRO. That used to be the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization,
yep.
A now defunct American UFO group.
Mm-hmm.
There was a great preliminary report done for the late Jim Lorenzen, who headed that organization.
Yep.
And it was discovered by, again, Jan Aldrich, the researcher responsible more than anybody for Project 1947, a great resource you have in the U.S., right?
Mm-hmm.
And he found this, and he sent it right to me. And he'd actually had the most detailed report of all, because that local APRO investigator got on the phone in the early days before there was any censoring and would just, you know, went as best he could at every spokesman and every person and got them to talk. And there was, it's actually one of the fourth and perhaps in some ways one of the more important resources we use to get the details.
Yeah.
You know? And those details, you know, it's great they were written down, Tim, because you know something, you find witnesses today and like, you know, memory's a very plastic, soft thing, right?
Yeah.
Even the divers, and I'd seen their name on some of the orders, you know, they were there, they couldn't even remember the year. And they were trying to be helpful, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, these guys, you remember, they were told to forget it, you know, loose lips sink ships, the Cold War is on, you know?
Yeah.
You know, it's hard to believe, but they couldn't even remember the year, and they guessed 62 when it was 67, this kind of thing. And these are people that are trying to be helpful. So when anybody writes something down, you go with that written record, you know, in the press or the statement at the time, because believe me, memory, it's a very soft thing. We've all gone back to that hill that we used to sled down and are just amazed how small it is, how big it is in our memory, right?
So, exactly.
Yeah.
And then you alluded to here what seems to be what has come out in the last 10 years since you've been doing the research, is that there was more going on in that area than they thought at the time. That even though it looked like there was just a search going on at Shag Harbor, there was also another search going on about 25 miles away, northwest, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you talk about that Shelburne search, because it sounds like that's the one that really was the UFO search.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the problems with the Shag Harbor incident is that, you know, it was some time before Navy divers were on the scene, right? And certainly all the other UFO incidents and some who weren't reported were quickly pushed aside, and Shag Harbor became forefront to the media's attention, right? they first arrived on the scene on Friday, October the 6th, and they dove all day that day. Now, this was a low-tech search. These were divers that were from what was known as the Fleet Diving Unit in Halifax.
Yep.
Also known as the Granby Divers. You know, their designation on their hats would have been HMCS Granby, Her Majesty's Canadian Ship Granby, which was one of the big diving tenders. They didn't take that down there. They hired a local boat after they had a Coast Guard boat for the first day. And look, they dove. It was basically, the effort was pairs of divers going down together with flashlights. Okay, there were seven of them all together, and they kept this up through the daylight hours. They checked. They laid out a grid pattern that ran from the initial impact site to the last known surface position. Now, the world watched this. There was, you know, film footage that was on CBC television news in the day, mm-hmm. and lots of people sitting around the shoreline watching this effort. But in some ways, this played into the authorities' hands, I believe, because, look, Canada in 1967 wasn't New Mexico in 47. You just couldn't push everybody away and say nothing here, or, you know, go home, or, you know, cordon off the area, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Things were more open. And the thing is, in some ways it played into their hands, because it's been suggested to me that what better way to cover up a UFO attempted recovery operation 25 miles away than have everybody in the world looking at a UFO crash site, which they're going to want to do.
Yeah.
Mind you, they had to search there anyway. There could have been debris, mm-hmm. unique trauma to the bottom, other things that I still look for in 1995 when I did my underwater search with sightings. But the real story, unknown to the public, I was told, according to the divers, was 25 miles away, less than a mile offshore from the Shelburne Base, which, as I said earlier, was a coordination center for submarine detection in the Atlantic.
Mm-hmm.
Ships quickly assembled over there, and what they saw on the bottom when divers went down and dropped cameras was two objects there, one loaning assistance to the other, and they described there being activity of some beings down there. Once this was detected, they were told simply to observe and not interfere. They did so for a week, at which time these objects began to move, went down the coast of the Gulf of Maine, surfaced, and flew away. Now, none of that Shelburne story has the documentation of the Shag Harbor crash site or the belief or search for a UFO there, right?
Yeah.
But there are secondary things that show that this story could very well be true. Like I mentioned earlier, some of the X-Files allude that there was indeed a second search, though it wasn't publicly known or admitted to, okay? The other thing is that exactly 1 week later, to the hour, two sets of lights are seen coming up out of the water in Shag Harbor and flying away.
Yeah.
And that was reported, and Mountie saw that again, too. So, you know, it fits the diver's story like a glove, right?
Yeah.
And I actually got that story from them before I had these documents or knew of the second sighting. And by the way, even that second sighting made the National Enquirer. So, you know, it wasn't just some little thing I found and made it fit, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So those things, although they're not official, do tend to support the diver's story of the second simultaneous search effort. But again, bear in mind, there's nothing official. Look, we have tons of documents that say, yes, the government believed a UFO crashed in Shag Harbor. Many people seen it, including Mounties, and we searched. The Shelburne story at this point is only a story, but there were certainly documents that allude there was a second search area, though there is no official paperwork to back that part up.
And can you extrapolate on what the diver said about the creatures working on the object and beings being down there? I'm sure that's obviously pretty sensational stuff. So, what kind
of
details? Well,
that part of the testimony from them to me was in a personal interview face to face, and there was witnesses there with me that heard this. I wasn't alone. And they had trouble talking about that, you know, because, like, as they said, that was the black box aspect of the case, right?
Yeah.
And they were very reluctant, and it was like, it was a bit like pulling teeth, but the way they put it is there was no doubt. You know, we were down there. That was no Russian sub. That was no experimental thing. You know, whatever it wasn't from here.
Yeah.
And once we seen it, we're that close, we were told, you know, that's, you know, we went up and reported that, and they're saying, well, don't do nothing. Leave the cameras down there. Eventually, apparently, 400 feet of film were shot, which, of course, we don't have, you know. And I was even told who the naval photographer was, and I went to his door in Ottawa, and all he said, he would add nothing to it. He said, whatever they told you is true. Close the door. Well, what they simply said was there was activity on there. We've seen beams and they were going. And, you know, when you try to get more detail out of them, it was weird. Obviously, it bothered these guys, and it was hard to tell whether the sort of pain in talking about that they were suffering had to do with maybe they were violating some security oath or it's just traumatic. I often had the impression that perhaps something happened down there and there was loss of life because, I mean, these guys, look, these guys did some pretty nasty work, hauling dead bodies or to crash airplanes, and, you know,
yeah,
they love to talk, that kind of stuff. And, you know, if there is such a thing as Iron Men, they were it. And yet they had trouble talking about this.
And did they ever describe the creatures or the beings?
No.
Nothing like that?
No. And when you push them in that direction, they would look at the floor and sort of wave their hand, like appeared to be troubled.
Wow.
Yeah, now this is like 26 years later I found them, right?
Yeah.
And like I said, these are guys that, you know, they haul their coworkers dead out of planes. And, you know, like a diver does some pretty unsavory work at times. You know?
Oh, definitely, yeah.
And this seemed to be difficult to talk about.
And you have no idea where that film ended up, huh? They don't even...
No, there's no... you know, the whole trick to finding these files, even the paperwork, is coming up with file names and locations, right?
Yeah.
No. But, you know, from that year, there is still a secret file in Ottawa. And this, we know this because when I was in Ottawa, and in 93, I did an on-site search there for paper records that could not be transferred to Halifax or kept, you know, in reference only.
Yeah.
And just before I went to look at the last box in a section of files that was called Records Group 24, before I could see it, they reassessed that box. It went across the street to a military section. It goes through it again. And when I got the box, it was described to be as being quite sizable, and I knew how big the file was. When I opened it up, there was only a few files in it, and there was a yellow piece of paper in the bottom attached to the draw sheet, and on that it actually said, this file has been sanitized, and it had the officer's name and date on it. It was that day, right? And right on it, it listed things that were taken, and one of the files taken actually said, it was called, believe it or not, it said, UFO crash, 1967, target detection and search and acquisition. It said 1967, and it had a line drawn through it, and it said top secret, you know, not to be released. So, I mean, gee, I wonder what event that was, you know. Like, I mean, and I never did get that one. I don't know if it was a piece of paper or film or what it was, you know, but I mean, it was listed as were many other documents that I'm not sure their title didn't reveal what they were, but strangely enough, that one did. I mean, you know, UFO crash 1967, you know, target detection and acquisition. Well, there was one other thing. It had a coding number on it. This is really quite funny, and sometimes government departments can be a real hoot when you do this work. It had a coding number. I didn't know what it meant. I can still remember the number. It said -3800-10-1, and then after that it had DRBS, and I assume the DRBS meant Defense Research Board here in Canada. So when I got out of that, I called the Defense Research Board, right?
Yeah.
And I had some person that was sitting on the computer for lunch for somebody, and asked them if they could just tell me what that number meant. And they tapped into the computer, and they go, isn't that weird? They go, that's a UFO with both radar and visual detection.
Huh.
So, you know, considering it said, you know, the operation and acquisition and everything, I guess that means they got it or tried or, you know.
Yeah.
Right? But pretty strange. But, I mean, despite the fact that so much in this is open and it's very different than what we usually see in these UFO crash scenarios, there is a black box aspect to this case, and there is a thing that there are things we have yet to get, okay?
Yeah.
And may never, of course, you know. But it's out there.
And when the Sag Harbor incident happened, how extensive was the U.S. involvement in this? Because obviously there seems to be sort of the idea that they would work hand in hand with the UFO.
Well, they did, and there was a lot of cooperation, and it only made sense. Like, bear in mind, like again, let's look at the background. You have two U.S. bases on Canadian soil in that corner of Nova Scotia, mm-hmm. right? The former Canadian Forces Station Barrington at Back Row, which was a NORAD radar facility, that end of the Pine Tree Line. You know, since it's just automated. I mean, everybody knows about the Dew Line, but there's a Mid Canada Line and a Pine Tree Line. Back Row was that end of the Pine Tree Line. And just a few miles away, you had Shelburne, and that was the coordination center for submarine detection in the Atlantic. It was hard-linked with Argentia Newfoundland in Key West, Florida, and they had microphoned the whole Atlantic Ocean.
Oh, wow.
And they also had a grid out there called the MAD grid, stood for Magnetic Anomaly Detection. So I imagine they knew where this thing was and where it blooped. So, you know, so I'm sure that by the time the Navy divers reached Shag Harbor, they told me they knew it wasn't there anymore.
Yeah.
But they had a look there, too. There might have been debris. There might have been this. Again, the search, according to them, was going on at Shelburne. Now, this is according to them. I don't have that on paper. We do know they were looking in Shag Harbor. The divers tell me they were also looking in Shelburne. So American involvement, you know, you have those two bases here. They were involved in the search effort, right? I mean, our shared defense out over the Gulf of Maine, at the time there was a U.S. carrier group there practicing for Vietnam. They got involved in the search and flew high-altitude missions over and took photos from there. And that was admitted in that APOR report. You know, the spokesman's name, the officer that admitted it, you know, it's all in that, the one that we gained from Jan Aldrich there, right?
Yeah.
So they were searching, right? People that were flying aircraft over the area and dropping sonar buoys in the search for this in the next few days talk about they were doing more interaction into American airspace than usual, and their planes were entering ours going back and forth to try to make a complete search grid, right? Now, those things would happen occasionally in search and rescue. You used to have to ask for clearance for each time you passed in. That had been waived, and they were freely moving between your and our airspace here, right?
Yeah.
So it was an exceptional thing. There were certain people who were brought off course here in Nova Scotia from another base that were brought into the search effort. So, you know, they were looking. They were looking hard, and many of those aspects like that involved U.S. staff, right? Like I say, those bases at the time were actually a shared facility. Before 1962, they would have flown the American flag only.
Yeah.
And in 67, those bases flew both Old Glory and Canada's, at that time, almost new flag. And, you know, it was a 50-50 staff basis, you know, set up through NORAD, right? But so you had American personnel looking from the two bases. You had American personnel from bases in Maine and from that carrier group flying over the area. So, you know, lots of U.S. involvement. Then when you look at the change of story, one of the only people who ever changed the story, the lightkeeper on Bon Portage Island now claims that he did find an artifact and turned it over to U.S. officials under orders of the Canadian Coast Guard. And I am still trying to find if that's indeed the case, if there was notes in his logbook or whatever. The Canadian Coast Guard claims to have lost all those records. That's their official stance, and I have paperwork in the cover letter saying that. But that's continuing. In fact, I'm about to start an effort where I make a complaint about that, and we'll see where that takes us. I'll start with the Information Commissioner. It could potentially be a court case within a year, so I don't know. You know, but I mean, this is still an active investigation. The case remains open and unsolved. And the official stance in the paperwork is still that they were searching for a UFO and they didn't get it. And there was no reason to think it was anything conventional.
One of the things that Stan Friedman talks about with the Roswell case is the race with the Undertaker, if you will, trying to get witnesses before they pass on. And obviously you have a 20-year advantage, I guess, on that because the Shag Harbor incident occurred in 67, not 47 like Roswell. So maybe you have less of a problem with that, but time is going forward, so it's obviously going to become a problem. But how do you deal with that, and are there new witnesses coming forward?
Well, yeah, there are. I mean, and as lucky as we've been, and as much work as myself and people like Don Ledger have done, there are still people we'd like to have talked to that, you know, have yet to be located, or sometimes it takes a few years for them to change their mind and be willing to talk, right? We haven't quite had a race against the Undertaker. It's been a concern, and a couple times that problem has reared its ugly head. For the most part, not, because, like to say, when I started, we had a 20-year advantage on when Roswell was first looked into, right?
Yeah.
Unfortunately, when it has occurred, it's been a problem at some bad times. For example, one of the people I would love to have chatted with was the former commanding officer of the Shelburne base, and when I finally located him, other members of his family took the phone to tell me he passed away 3 days before.
Oh, man.
Unfortunate. That's one of the few times it was like in a real key position like that, right?
Yeah.
But for the most part, no. I mean, I have talked to all three of the RCMP officers on the scene, the seven reporting eyewitnesses that initially reported, the three men who were on the first Coast Guard boat to respond. In fact, just days ago, I spoke to one of them. And, you know, we've been lucky, and of course many of them, and there's a huge amount of non-reporting witnesses.
Yeah.
And in fact, it's interesting, the Sag Harbor Incident falls into that ideal ratio. You know, UFO researchers would often tell you that for every witness that reports, you'll find 10 that didn't. Mm-hmm. 7 reported initially that night, and on last count, my witness interview list is up around 70.
Oh, wow.
Of those who, you know, seen it firsthand, right? So there's been a couple of key times when, yes, the Undertaker, you know, issue has come up. You know, the people are no longer with us. I would like to talk to. For the most part, though, it's not near the problem it's been in Roswell. And we have found most of the people we wanted to.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and that was a blessing.
And then as the principal investigator of the Sag Harbor incident, the guy who really kind of put it on the map, how much do you have to deal with ill-informed media getting involved, the skeptics who always seem to conveniently get the facts mm-hmm. wrong when they debunk the cases,
right.
and that kind of stuff? I mean, does that get on your nerves, and how often do you have to deal with that?
It happens occasionally. I like to think I've gotten better at dealing with it. It's not a big problem, right? Most people, if they do the research or look at this case, realize that it was something serious, and it's been treated serious, right?
Yeah.
There hasn't been it hasn't been attacked. Was it Stan likes to call the noisy negativists?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, look, when I've given lectures in the U.S., I've been surprised. I've been almost disappointed, to be honest, but few have tackled me. I think they realize when they hear me speak, I'm fairly well-researched. My memory's largely intact, right? And, you know, when they point out something, you have a question, I can usually answer it, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, for somebody that tries to make a ridiculous statement, I love to crush the question when I can, and I often can, you know. If I don't know something, I'm not afraid to say I don't know or if I made a mistake. And I think that's helped. But, look, there's not been a lot of that. When it does happen, it's usually the result of somebody wanting to do a very limited segment on it, you know, as part of under the umbrella of some silly show, you know, on the paranormal or something.
Yeah.
In which case, I usually don't get involved. But I've yet to have anybody attack it or completely dismiss it. I mean, there have been better and poorer treatments of the subject matter. But for me, it's not a big problem. And, you know, if they come at me silly, they start realizing it's serious. And if they look at the material, they realize it is. It's not a big issue. But, you know, you deal with those things. The other thing is I'm kind of prepared now. When somebody asks a question or they want to do a treatment, you know, I have answers and overviews that fit a 1 minute treatment, a 5 minute treatment, or an hour treatment, you know, and I think I've gotten better at giving what they want, you know. I mean, that helps too, but I mean, there are people I say no to occasionally. And it's usually because, you know, they're trying to boil it down just too much or it's under the umbrella of something silly, you know, I mean, you know,
exactly.
That happens. It's not been a big issue, you know, to be honest. Not for me, but. When you get somebody calling, they're irritating. They know how to do it, you know.
Yeah. One of the things we were talking about before we went on the air was this new case in Prince Edward Island, which is where my family has a lot of family up there and vacation time a lot up in PEI. So talk a little bit about this Prince Edward Island incident that you said that you thought was going to be it was a pretty solid case.
Well, it appears to be. It's one that's been interesting. I tried to look into it a couple times with my spare time when I'm not working on others. It's not very well known to the public. It's gotten a little attention lately because it's been included in, amongst many other Canadian cases, in a book called The Canadian UFO Report, written by Chris Rakowski and Jeff Dittman, two well-known UFO researchers up here. It's an excellent book. And it's got a good chapter which has the most information so far on the Ebenezer case, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's another case. It's a landing case where something landed on the property of a resident near Ebenezer, a small village outside Charlottetown, the only real city on the island.
Yeah.
Technically, Summerside is, but these are small communities, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the nearby residents called RCMP. They responded to the scene, and it appears now that perhaps the military recovered something and put it away. And so far, there's not been a whole lot of in-depth research, and like say, Rakowski's managed to bring together the little bit that have been brought together from a lot of people and some recently released documents from our National Archives, and it does paint a picture that, and certainly there's a lot of room in it that obviously there's some gaps to fill in, and it does look like another case where something indeed physical did land on the ground and was recovered, and it's largely unknown. It was in the media at the time, but it's another one of these cases where nobody could you know, come up with the definitive answers, and again, it just slipped out of the public's mind. Mm-hmm. But with the release of these documents and the involvement, again, once again, of the Rescue Coordination Center and RCMP and the military, it does appear there was something going on, right?
Yeah.
Now, there's been some practical explanations suggested for it, like an errant sea-barrel missile from a Navy ship and a meteorite. And there was a meteorite shower the day before and these kinds of things. But it's one of these cases, when you look at all the observed facts that were reported that we are certain of,
yeah,
none of those explanations suffice. It's like Shag Harbor. You can say, well, maybe it was a flare. Maybe it was this. Maybe it was that. You make the suggestion, I'll tell you why it couldn't be.
Yeah.
You know, not just based on opinion, but based on the composite observed facts. And at this point, it's a teaser. It's a case where I'm hoping to do some more research on, and I'm sure others are here in Canada. And, you know, in a few years, and with a bit of luck and certainly some hard work, this may become as significant as Shag Harbor. It's a little early to say. I'd like to think it is. It looks promising.
And what year was that?
1990.
Oh, wow. So it's really
recent. So, yeah, again, you know, certainly within people's memory. In fact, you know, occasionally when people see one of my television shows and just tracks me down by phone, I've had people call and report a sighting they've seen back then. They don't know what's that. They probably saw it from the distance.
Yeah.
So it seems to have been widely observed. And, in fact, it was even seen across here in Nova Scotia from across the water. PEI is like, you know, there's a narrow strait between, might be varies from 9 to 14 miles across, right?
Yeah.
And people seem to see it on both sides. And one of the things that's clear when you look at the documents from the Rescue Coordination Center, it was widely reported. So, you know. So I'm hoping this one progresses too, you know.
Yeah. And then just as a big picture question here as we head towards the end, and that's about Canadian ufology. Did it develop sort of in tandem with American ufology? Because you said, you know, like there was an APRO guy up there, and I know they MUFON Canada branches. Is it sort of like that kind of thing?
Yeah. In the early years, it pretty much mirrored the American situation,
mm-hmm.
both in the, you know, how authorities went about it and also, you know, how the civilian groups went about it.
Yeah.
But from the mid-late 60s on, as time went on, it kind of diverged, and Canada kind of found its own way.
Okay.
And when you think about it, I mean, in 69, when the Condon Report came out and officially ended the United States Air Force's involvement, in at least publicly, with UFO cases and the phenomena, that, you know, it kind of took the wind out of the sails of the big groups at the time, and things kind of ended up in disarray.
Yeah.
And in Canada, it was actually quite different. Because of cases like Shag Harbor and the Stephen Mishalik case out in the prairies, it was decided in Ottawa in 1968 that UFO investigation should be taken away from the military and be given to Canada's National Research Council for serious scientific study, which it was. And they would call on military field units and anything else they needed as needed.
Yeah.
And in the beginning, that was done. But over the years, that effort kept getting watered down, and as staff retired, it wasn't being passed on to new people.
Mm-hmm.
And by 1999, the effort had just evaporated away and been penny pinched into nothing. And officially, they got out of the business then. But for some time through the 60s, 70s, and 80s, certainly Canada's National Research Council investigated cases, and there were a few staff who, again, did a pretty good job. But they never did call on the field units they needed as much as they could have, you know. It probably would have been better to leave it with the military, because I know the Corps of people there did a pretty fair job. So, again, from 67, 68, 69, our history and the way that was handled in this country starts to diverge from, before that time, would have closely followed the American model.
Yeah.
After that, it diverged more and more. But in the end, strangely enough, we're again pretty much in the same place, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And, of course, nowadays, you know, the public has a greater knowledge. Information shared quickly on the Internet. It's been both a good thing and a bad thing. I largely kind of try to avoid it. I think sometimes everybody tries to investigate these things from the armchair, which doesn't work well.
Mm-hmm.
Look, I'll give you one quick example of that. I'm going to tell you something. You know, when you communicate by email, you can get some raw data, right?
Yeah.
But even to use the telephone is often work to my advantage. You'll talk to a witness and he's forgetful, and sometimes I'll hear his wife in the background tapping someone on the shoulder saying, oh dear, you remember that was the night that. Well, I would have lost that data if I hadn't heard that and got the wife on the phone, mm-hmm. you know? The other thing is face-to-face. You know, you can sometimes pick up things you wouldn't even pick up in the voice, or certainly not in the email, you know, in terms of deception or, you know.
Yeah.
You have to get out of the armchair in these cases with depth and knock on doors and tromp through the woods and, you know, the other thing is, like, if you simply rely on, you know, what everybody else is doing, you know, there's a place in this, I think, for us rugged individuals with the odd original idea.
Exactly.
And you know, you got to do that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the trouble is, many people, you know, the Internet is a great tool, and I use it. Look, but, I mean, when you get on there in these listservs and people argue and fight about the facts, sometimes it ends up that, unfortunately, ufologists will sometimes end up like a lot of medieval monks who are sitting together arguing vehemently about how many angels sit on the head of a pin.
Yeah.
What does it matter? Who the cares? No. Get out of the chair, get the data, show us what you got, and we can accept or reject it or build on it, you know, the
exactly.
way it used to be done.
What's next for Chris Stiles? What do you have on your plate coming up in the future?
Well, Sag Harbor goes on for me.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm still, for example, I may even do an underwater search in the future if there's enough interest, right?
Mm-hmm.
There is an unusual sonar target that was not properly investigated when I did my 95 search. The chance of physical evidence still beyond the parameters of the initial naval search in my last effort in 1995 still exists. The premise is valid today.
Yeah.
Considering the relatively low cost, if I can drum up enough money interest, that's one thing. But there's more doors to knock on, more lines to draw, more connections to be made with Sag Harbor, and other classic cases here in Atlantic Canada. I've also spent a fair time looking at the European model and seeing some of these cases and certainly other encounter cases through the Valley sort of model of reality transformation,
yeah,
which interests me. And I think you have to remember, UFO phenomenon is a worldwide phenomenon, and sometimes you can spend too much time looking at North American way of doing things.
Exactly.
So Chris here is looking in that direction and perhaps splashing around in the water one more time for Sag Harbor. And, you know, like you mentioned earlier, Ebenezer and other cases. Basically, I like the meat and potatoes cases where you have multiple witnesses, government reports, something that you can get your teeth into, right?
Yeah.
But I must admit, at times it's hard to believe that Shag has gone as far as it did. I remember when I looked in. I mean, I always believed it would, but again, nobody seems to have been able to explain it or explain it away, and it still remains the world's only UFO crash scenario that is supported in that interpretation. By government documents that here in Canada are freely available, there's absolutely no controversy as to their origin or their authenticity.
Are you surprised just how big the Sag Harbor thing got? It sounds like you kind of are.
The Sag Harbor's pretty surprised, too. And the communities had, you know, they've become comfortable with it and adjusted. And unfortunately, yes, people do sell T-shirts there and that. I mean, in the beginning when I used to go down, I'd go in somewhere to talk to somebody, I used to be asked to leave. It's changed. And I knew that the day would come when that would happen. For the most part, it's done in a tasteful way. And, you know, they've largely avoided the silly season stuff. And, you know, that's all you can hope for. But I think that if the case is to remain current and of interest, there is more work to be done on it, even in the physical sense. I mean, in how many places is there good reason to still go and look and dive and look for a UFO or flying saucer? I mean, you know,
exactly, yeah.
It's an opportunity, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I keep the door open for that and for other things. But, yes, I'm still surprised. I mean, the other thing, Tim, was how quick it came out of the blocks, right?
Yeah.
And to put this in perspective, look, I started looking into this thing seriously in very early in 1993, right?
Mm-hmm.
But before 1994, I never flew in an aircraft.
Oh, wow.
And now I've been all over the place talking about this thing, and I'm very surprised, you know. Like, and I think even more surprised because when I started, it was just out of personal interest.
Yeah.
And I think many times when I look at some of the disappointments, despite all the good things that happened, if I didn't have that honest, true personal, if I wasn't passionate about it, I would have given up a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and some people can suggest, oh, well, why wouldn't you do it? You had a trip to Toronto or New York or you know, oh, believe me. If it wasn't, I don't like going anywhere when I got to take three different airplanes.
Exactly. Yeah.
I don't like it that much, but I can tell you, if you know, when you hear the people that, you know, some of the accusations made, look, if you didn't have a true passion for this, you wouldn't persist. You wouldn't keep up, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, to me, that's what it's all about. Look, this all comes under the bigger thing of are we alone to me, right?
Mm-hmm.
And to me, it doesn't matter where the answer comes from, the people at SETI or some lucky individual or space or from the UFO phenomena. That's really what we're trying to prove here. Now, I know many of us and the believers, they don't require that, but I would like to find the kind of evidence that I could drag into a skeptic and they can't deny it, right?
Yeah.
It's like I've often said when I'm on the stage doing a live presentation. I'd love to walk out someday with the door off this thing and drop it on the stage and it makes a loud clang. That's when I'll be happy.
And what about upcoming speaking engagements and that kind of thing? I know you're going to be down here in the Boston.
Well, yes. Other than a local effort, one of the things that's coming up for the 40th anniversary is this October, just days afterwards, I'm going to be in the Boston area. I believe it's Watertown?
Yeah.
There's an event there known as the Massachusetts Monster Mash. Is that it?
Yeah, it's a weekend thing. One night is more cryptozoology based,
right. and apparently I'm going to be a keynote speaker there. And Don Ledger's coming down and doing a presentation, co-author that I wrote the book with, and Michael McDonald, a Canadian filmmaker who produced a feature documentary on Chegg and other UFO works, is going to be there, selling some of his works, things that are not available in the U.S. So. Hopefully we have a good time and people enjoy the presentation, and I already received a lot of good feedback where people seem quite interested in what we have to offer, and I'm sure it'll be a great time. I've always enjoyed driving down through New England, and it's going to be a driving trip this time, and I'm very much looking forward to it. Plus checking out some of the music stores, one of my other hobbies, and I can hardly wait. But yeah, this October, looking forward to it in the greater Boston area to talk about Chegg Harbor and the 40th anniversary and all other things UFO, Tim.
Nice. And I'll put a link up to the Monster Mash website on
that. And I hope to see you there and get a chance
to
meet.
Yes, you will see me there. I owe you a dinner for sure.
Yeah, and there are several other people that I haven't met yet in the field that are at this point just a voice on the phone, and I'm very much looking forward to going down.
Yeah, so
for me, it'll be a great UFO event and a social event, and can't wait.
Awesome, awesome. Well, Chris, thank you very much for coming on the show. It should be noted here that we had already taped an interview, but the technical difficulties crashed on the interview that we'd done back in April. So you were kind enough to come back on here and do a whole new interview, and I tremendously appreciate that.
I believe in doing things right, and look, I thank you for your interest.
Well, thank you very much for coming on the show. You've done just tremendous work. If not for you, then no one would even have heard of the Chegg Harbor incident. So, I mean, we need more ufologists like you doing the legwork, interviewing the witnesses, getting the documents, and really hammering these cases and finding the really good cases. And like I said, without Chris Stiles, there probably wouldn't be any Chegg Harbor incident. We wouldn't know about it, and we wouldn't even be having this conversation.
So. And I'm convinced there are more cases like that out there. Awesome. Everybody should be looking at those classy cases that are largely unknown. There's more out there.
Definitely, definitely. Yeah. Well, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
There you have it, folks. That does it for this week's edition of Banal of America Audio. Big, big thanks to Chris Stiles for coming on the show. Chris does not have a website, but you can reach him at his email address, shagharbor@hotmail.com, shagharbour@hotmail.com. Moving right along now, it's time for the return of Banal of America Audio, listener feedback. In light of last week's somewhat depressing end cap to the show, we're going with a very uplifting email here for our listener feedback, and it comes from Craig in Laurel, Maryland. Here's what Craig has to say. I am constantly impressed with the shows you are cranking out. For your critics, I would say this: opinions are like assholes. Everybody's got one. For you, I would say, stick with what you've got here. You're doing great. Part of what I like most about your show is the raw, underground feel to it. Once a show gets too polished, I think it loses some of its edge. C2C may wish they were still in the cave, but with their 40 minutes of commercials and 10 minutes of content, they have truly lost their spirit. You've got it. Don't let the critics talk you out of it. Looking forward to next week's show. Signed, Craig in Laurel, Maryland. Thank you very much for writing in, Craig. Thank you so much for your kind words. I appreciate what you have to say, and I think that part of the appeal of BOA for our vast audience is this raw, underground feel to the program. We don't have the backing of some fat cat radio conglomerate. We're just a simple little program trying to make ends meet, trying to put out the best stuff we can week in and week out, because I'm an esoteric radio fan, and I know what I want to hear on esoteric radio, And to be quite honest with you, I'm not hearing it on Esoteric Radio. That's how Banal of America Audio was born and became developed. Esoteric Radio from an Esoteric Radio listener for other Esoteric Radio listeners. That's what BOA Audio is all about. So, thank you so much for the letter, Craig. A very uplifting correspondence that puts a little wind in our sails here as we close out this week's program. If you'd like to be a part of Banal of America Audio listener feedback, there's two ways to go about doing it. Either A, click the contact button in the left-hand side of the screen. Yes, folks, we've moved the menu. By the time you're listening to this, the front page of banalofamerica.com will be all redesigned, all fancy schmancy and pretty cool looking. The contact button will now be on the left-hand side. On the menu, you'll see it. It says contact. You click that. That'll take you to the contact page with the appropriate information to get in touch with me. Or simply write to boaaudio@hotmail.com, boaaudio@hotmail.com, all one word. Either one of those methods will put your correspondence on the road to being featured on Banal of America Audio listener feedback. Up next, of course, it's the thanks. Big, huge, super huge thanks to the great staff at banalofamerica.com, Leslie, Chiron, R. Lee, Joe V., and Tina Senna, for your help and support with the audio series and the website. Top-notch reading material, week in, week out, they're providing it. You never know what you're going to find at banalofamerica.com, but you can be certain that it'll be handcrafted esoterica from some of the finest minds in the field. If you're only listening to the radio program and you're not reading the columns at BOA, you're only getting half the story. Check out their columns. They are fantastic, and you can find them at BOA, plus the vast archive of columns from each of these great writers. Banalofamerica.com, make it a part of your everyday search for esoteric news and opinion. If you're a longtime Banal of America audio listener or an appreciative newcomer and you want to help support the audio series, or just say, hey, thanks for a fantastic season 2 so far, there's a way you can do it. Go to banalofamerica.com, click the PayPal button. It's right there in the center of the screen with this new front page redesign, and make a donation. No donation is too small, and all donations go towards keeping banalofamerica.com and BOA Audio up and running and paying the bills for the audio series. Whatever you can do to help will be greatly appreciated. Next week on the program, it's another UFO episode. I like to try and buffer them a little bit, but the way the schedule seems to be working out for us here in the final weeks, it's not going to happen that way. So it's going to be back-to-back UFO episodes, and it's going to be back-to-back quality UFO episodes, because next week's guest is Robert Hastings, whose specialization is the UFO-nukes connection. Robert Hastings has spent the last 30 years looking at the strange correlation between UFO sightings and nuclear bases. He'll share his research with BOA Audio as we discuss what made him decide to focus on this aspect of the UFO phenomenon, how Robert cultivates his whistleblower testimony, his chagrin with FOIA requests, contemporary UFO slash nuke sightings, discussion of the 1967 Malmstrom base case and the 1964 Big Sur case, plus big picture speculation on what it all might mean. The UFO Nukes Connection, Robert Hastings, next week on Banal of America Audio, Be There or Be Square. And on that note, we wrap it up here for the week. Thank you so much for listening, folks. You'll be hearing from me next week. Until then, this is Tim Banal, signing off.